of Syria came out to celebrate with scenes of victory in Umayyad Square in the country's capital, Damascus. Scores of people poured out onto the streets of the port city of Tartus on the Mediterranean Sea, with similar images popping out from all over the nation. With a turnout rate of 78.6%, this is quite a remarkable feat. In European elections, the turnout rate is usually somewhere between 50 and 60%. The turnout rate in the 2020 presidential elections in the US was around a record-breaking 67%. The head of the Syrian parliament, Hamoud Sabah, announced the results of the election with around 14 million Syrians who came out to vote, which, given the situation of so many Syrians displaced by the war and the country still in turmoil, is very impressive. Now, before a single vote was cast, Western nations were already attempting to undermine the Syrian presidential elections. Several of them outright rejected the results in advance and proceeded to call the elections undemocratic. They claimed that the elections were illegitimate because they allegedly left many Syrians excluded. Ironically, these very same countries themselves prevented Syrians living abroad from even voting in the first place. For example, in Canada and Germany, Syrians were prevented from casting ballots at the Syrian consulate. These very same countries who pretend to be liberal democracies then turn around and deny Syrians the right to participate in their own presidential elections and prevent them from exercising their right to vote, which is a pivotal part of any supposed democracy. This claim that Syrians were purposely excluded was not just repeated by Western countries, but also by the opposition and opposition figures, which is all the more ridiculous given that the opposition, they are the ones who boycotted the electoral process, refusing to participate. In the northern city of Idlib, which is home to thousands of foreign-backed terrorists, of course it is not possible to partake in the election. The same rings true for the areas controlled by the American occupation and Kurdish forces in the northeast regions of Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor, where they are busy plundering Syria's oil, of course.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
Now, in the media, the reporting about the elections has been abysmal. We have witnessed a concerted campaign by the corporate mainstream media to smear Syrians and their elections and to openly lie about the will of the Syrian people. Not one mainstream outlet in the West has even had any Syrian officials on to comment about the election. Only opposition figures. The media have also resorted to talking about the staged Duma gas attack of 2018. This alleged gas attack was used as a pretext by the United States, Britain, and France to illegally bomb Syria. It was subsequently proven that this gas attack never took place, a false flag operation designed to blame the Syrian government as the Syrian army made its final push to take back the surrounding areas of Ghouta in the Damascus countryside. We have seen through leaked documents published by WikiLeaks that this gas attack never happened. The very same inspectors sent by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, to investigate reported only trace quantities of chlorine, physical symptoms inconsistent with the gas attack, and ballistics showing the alleged gas canister to have been manually placed at the site. The inspectors concluded that given the lack of evidence, no gas attack had materialized and expressed concern after their findings had been removed. The OPCW's leadership doctored the reports of the fact-finding mission, removing key evidence in an attempt to cover up the truth and proceeding to smear its own scientists who blew the whistle. During this latest election in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad went to Duma to cast his ballot. The mainstream media used this photo op as an opportunity to revive the lies surrounding this staged gas attack and to attempt to smear the Syrian government and President al-Assad once more. Right now in Syria, many people are suffering due to the terrible economic situation and havoc brought on by sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union. Universally, in almost every article and television report on the topic of Syrian elections, the mainstream media talks of the economic turmoil that Syrians are living through, without ever mentioning that this suffering, the long breadlines, the wait of almost 2 days just for fuel, is a direct consequence of Western sanctions. The media talk about Syrians living in poverty to illustrate the people's purported dissatisfaction with al-Assad, giving the impression that it is the fault of the Syrian government. First of all, this has nothing to do with elections. Second, this is not only untrue, but more importantly, it is a whitewashing of Western crimes. Syrians are suffering and starving right now precisely because of the West's foreign policy and imperialism. Yet this is rarely ever mentioned, if at all. If one wants a real example of propaganda, they need look no further than how the Western media reports on all matters related to Syria. It's frankly astonishing how anyone can make a report about the Syrian elections and not mention a simple, basic truth, that the majority of Syrians support Bashar al-Assad. If these so-called liberal democracies in Europe and North America care so much about democracy and the will of the people, why do they ignore this fact? It is incredible how not one report or article mentions this. The media call the elections a sham, but they talk about everything else without actually explaining why. They obfuscate and change the subject by mentioning the economic turmoil, but don't tell you that this is the fault of Western sanctions, and they try to make it sound like it's al-Assad's fault or the Syrian government is to blame. They talk about democracy, but don't tell you that the majority of Syrians support al-Assad, nor do they show any of the images of countless Syrians taking to the streets in a show of support and to celebrate his victory. They lie, they deny reality, and deceive to manufacture consent for regime change. That is what you call propaganda. Joining me is former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Thank you for your time. It's great having you on the program, Your Excellency.
It's a pleasure.
Ambassador, the British government, along with the Americans and others, they called the elections in Syria, quote-unquote, undemocratic and illegitimate. They've outright rejected the results before the elections even took place. Could you give us an insight into what the motivations behind this are?
In a word, revenge. The Western powers, Britain and America in particular, are bitter because they have failed in their 10-year-long campaign to change the government in Syria. And they are therefore very bitterly disappointed because the recent elections served to underline their failure and to cement the position of President Assad in power. So what we heard was the sound, if I can put it this way, the sound of sour grapes.
So having been posted in Damascus and spent several years there, what do you make of the legislative and the electoral process in Syria?
Well, I don't think there can be any doubt that a majority of the Syrian people do not share the West's wish to get rid of President Assad. On the contrary, the president is seen by indisputably by a majority of Syrians as representative of stability. They do not, the Syrian people, without a shadow of a doubt, do not want to make a leap into the dark by getting rid of the president that they know. And when there is no alternative in prospect, who could unite the country, take the country forward in the next steps. Rather the reverse. I'm quite sure that a majority, an authentic majority of the Syrian people have confidence in their president. They may grumble about the conduct of the government, rising prices, corruption, alleged maladministration, that sort of thing. Which country is free from such grumbling? Certainly not my own, the UK. And indeed, I believe that the level of support for the president is authentically well above the estimated 40% level of support enjoyed in the opinion polls by Boris Johnson and his government. I believe that the Conservatives or Labour would be absolutely over the moon to have the level of support that President Assad has.
When you say that Syrians don't want to take a leap into what is essentially the unknown, what do you think the alternative is? What is the alternative that the West is proposing to President Assad?
The West is always careful not to spell out any alternative. because they know full well that the only realistic alternative would be a radical Islamist regime. They are totally irresponsible in wishing for what they call euphemistically a transition, which is translated means a regime change, but that phrase has had a lot of bad publicity, so they call it transition. They don't ever say transition to what, and there is no Nelson Mandela waiting in the wings in Syria. In fact, most Syrian people could not put a name on any Syrian opposition leader. I would be hard-pressed myself, and I'm a so-called expert. There are no plausible rivals, alternative political leaders to the president. There are warlords. There are warlords who, like such as those who rule the roost in Idlib province, who would undoubtedly, after fighting among themselves, inherit the crown in Damascus if the Western powers had their way.
In the early days of Tony Blair's government, the United Kingdom and other countries, they actually seem to be or appear to be on good terms with President al-Assad. I mean, what do you make of the current stance of the last 10 years from those in British politics and media who insist that Syrians are not deciding their own future and who've done this complete 180?
A lot of things have happened since those heady days in the early 2000s when Bashar al-Assad was having tea with Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace. And was being seen as the new white hope, and who was moving forward with liberalization of the economy in a way that was applauded in the West. And indeed, it was partly those efforts at liberalization by causing some suffering for the working classes in Syria and privileging of the middle class with this so-called liberalization. This was one of the reasons for the discontent which precipitated the uprising. But things have obviously moved on, and what Britain in particular cannot stomach is the fact that Syria has worked more and more closely with Russia and Iran, and therefore victory for Syria, victory for President Assad would be seen as victory for the leadership of Russia and Iran. This is something that the British government cannot stomach. So you have to see relations with Syria in the context of British relations with Russia and Iran. Poor old Syria is just the victim in the middle.
So just to wrap up, just as a last question, Ambassador, what do you think that al-Assad will do during his next term? What will be the next moves, do you think, from all these various governments that are trying to remove him and topple him? How do you see the rest of the war playing out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the options the president must be looking at is whether to make a move on Idlib now that his hands are less tied than they were, although this is a difficult moment internationally in one way because of the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran over nuclear and sanctions, and I can see some argument for not rocking the boat in Syria before that matter is settled. But in due course, I'm quite convinced that the Syrian government will move to repacify the northeast. I can see increasing pressure on the U.S. Presence in northeast Syria. The tribes of that area, the Arab tribes of that area, are mostly very pro-Assad. They will not tolerate the Kurdish suzerainty, which the American forces are imposing on them. But above all, I think the president will have his work cut out to cope with this continuing economic warfare. There is no doubt that it's the Western sanctions, which are the biggest obstacle to Syrian reconstruction, and not just reconstruction, but even getting back a normal, ordinary life with availability of fuel and bread. I'm sure that will be the president's number one priority.
Ambassador Peter Ford, thank you so much for your time, Your Excellency. I'm very grateful for you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Countries that have rejected the election results in Syria, dubbing the elections undemocratic, they have been trying to push an agenda and topple the Syrian government now for over 10 years. They have no genuine interest in the will of the Syrian people. They are most concerned with enacting their foreign policy objectives in ensuring profits for their multinational corporations and in expanding their empires. This notion of calling foreign leaders illegitimate or calling elections undemocratic is a tactic often used by the West when talking about countries that they have an imperialist agenda in. We have seen the United States, Britain, and the European Union do the same thing with the Venezuela's presidential elections and its parliamentary elections, which we covered in late 2020 on this program. We have seen the West do the exact same to Evo Morales in Bolivia in late 2019 when he was overthrown by right-wing groups supported by the West. And in the case of Venezuela, this notion of legitimacy has also been used by the Bank of England as a ruse to steal over $1 billion in gold belonging to the Venezuelan people. The West loves to pretend that it has the moral high ground. They speak about Syria, Venezuela, and others as if they are colonies under their rule. This is a colonial mindset. Who are these countries to talk about rejecting the results of the Syrian elections? The results of the Syrian elections are for the Syrian people to decide. And Syrians only, not some men in Whitehall, Washington, D.C., or Paris. I find it incredible that the United States has the gall to lecture other countries about democracy when its own citizens are disenfranchised from voting. African Americans are still treated like second-class citizens, and Native Americans completely removed from any political capacity, wiped out through centuries of genocide. How can the United Kingdom lecture anyone about democracy when its judiciary is controlled by the United States, when it gives immunity to American spies who kill British citizens, or when Julian Assange is rotting away in Belmarsh prison for exposing the war crimes of the U.S. empire? Where is the respect for an independent press and fourth estate? The United States and Britain together have colonized and plundered the world for centuries. To this day, they continue to overthrow the democratically elected governments of Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They are the last people on earth to be giving lectures about democracy. The fact of the matter is, there has been a cold, calculated attempt to overthrow the Syrian government for decades. We know from General Wesley Clark that a neocon plan for regime change has been put in place during the Bush years, with Syria on the list of targets. We have seen the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus already in 2006 about how best to exploit the weaknesses of Bashar al-Assad in order to destabilize Syria. The United States created al-Qaeda during the Cold War, then with Britain proceeded to help create ISIS through the invasion of Iraq in 2003. With their allies, such as Israel and Turkey, they have provided weapons, logistics, and assistance to terrorist groups inside Syria. and then the media tries to whitewash them as moderate rebels. Since the start of the so-called Arab Spring or uprising in 2011, they have been trying to topple the Syrian government and turn the whole country into another failed puppet state, as they have done to so many others. Through their imperialist greed, they have completely, utterly destroyed Syria. These actors do not have Syria's best interests at heart, nor do they care about the will of the Syrian people. Quite the opposite. What Syrians have done through these elections is reaffirm their sovereignty, cementing their stance against imperialism and against colonialism. The election results are not just a victory for President Assad, they are a victory for the Syrian people. Syrians have shown their resolve and their spirit to be unbreakable. Even after 10 years of war and all the suffering that has come with it, they have been unrelenting. Once again, they are showing the world that they will not allow others to dictate their political, economic, and social affairs. Syrians will not allow foreign-backed terrorists and militias, nor any other governments, to come in and tell them how to run their country. Syrians want a secular, stable Syria under Bashar al-Assad, which stands with the axis of resistance, which stands with Palestinians, which stands against imperialism, and guarantees a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, harmonious, and peaceful society for all Syrians. No matter what the media says, no matter how much propaganda they produce, and how much they try to sell regime change, Syrians are saying they will not be coerced or bullied into conforming to Western foreign policy objectives. Syrian matters are for Syrians only to decide. If President Bashar al-Assad did not have the support of the Syrian people, he could never have remained in power and withstood 10 years of war against him, and withstood 10 years of the United States, Britain, and Israel, and so many other countries and their terrorist groups trying to get rid of him. No one could. It's unconscionable to think that anyone could survive such a feat without the backing of their own people. Syrians have shown that they support their president and their government, both during wartime and in their elections. For anyone to deny this is simply to deny reality. It's not about one's opinion or what one thinks. This is about understanding the truth on the ground. We also have to look at this election through the lens of resistance. What Syrians do every day, what they have done for years, is resist imperialism through all means necessary. This huge turnout and landslide victory also symbolizes a victory for the axis of resistance as a whole. When we talk about the axis of resistance, we're talking about the nations that the West has tried to break and intimidate, such as Syria, Iran, Palestine, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, North Korea. We have seen during this vicious war against Syria how the whole world rallied behind the U.S. empire and joined them in their regime change project. Very few stood by Syria's side and remained with the Syrian people. Iran and Russia have helped Syria to stay afloat and to resist this onslaught. When Syria was in its darkest hour and on the verge of falling into the hands of Daesh, they answered the call to aid. They stepped in to provide and help to prevent the unthinkable from happening. They have stood steadfast with the Syrian people, respecting their will and protecting their sovereignty from foreign aggression, both militarily and politically. The entire apparatus of the mainstream media continues to repeat the same lies about Syria in a multitude of languages and mediums. There is complete uniformity and hegemony between the corporate media and the foreign policy objectives of Western governments. Inextricably intertwined, these two institutions work in tandem, and everything they have reported on Syria for the last 10 years has been almost entirely propaganda, and the presidential elections of 2021 are no different. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com parstoday.com/parstodayenglish. Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars, as the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden joins long line of presidents to woefully undercount civilians killed in U.S. wars. Here's more. Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars, as the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. According to a Department of Defense report, U.S. forces killed 23 civilians last year during military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. However, the true number of civilians killed by U.S. attacks in 2020 was far higher, according to organizations that monitor such casualties. The UK-based journalistic monitoring group Air Wars, for example, reported between 34 and 36 civilian deaths caused by U.S.-led attacks on Daesh targets in Iraq and Syria last year. Air Wars also reported between 7 and 13 civilians killed by U.S. forces in Somalia last year. A December 2020 report by Nita C. Crawford of the Cost of War Project, a team of 50 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs in Rhode Island found that at least 83 civilians were killed in 24 separate U.S. attacks in the first 9 months of last year. While the discrepancy between the number of civilian casualties in 2020 acknowledged by the U.S. and figures reported by independent monitors and media is stark, it was even greater in 2019. That year, the Pentagon claimed responsibility for 132 civilian deaths, while Air Wars and the Cost of War Project reported more than 1,100 civilians killed by U.S.-led attacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria alone. The dramatic decline in civilians killed and injured by U.S. forces is a result of a major decrease in overall American bombing attacks in at least six nations targeted in the so-called War on Terror. Air Wars estimates U.S. warplanes and drones carried out approximately 1,000 strikes last year, down from around 3,500 bombings in 2019 and 13,000 airstrikes in 2016, the last full year of the Obama administration. Hannah Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project, blasted the latest administration to undercount the number of civilians killed in U.S. wars. Almost 20 years into our country's unending conflicts, the Biden administration joins its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians, likely all black or brown people, killed or injured in U.S. military operations overseas, Shamsi said in a statement, adding, compared to credible independent media accounts, United Nations reporting and rights groups' investigations, it is clear that the Defense Department's investigations and acknowledgement of civilian harm remain woefully inadequate. The grossly inadequate official accounting for the cost and consequences of the United States' lethal actions abroad prevents meaningful public oversight and accountability for wrongful deaths and perpetual war policies, Shamsi added. Civilian victims, their families, and the American public deserve far better than this. Successive U.S. administrations have attempted to undercount or conceal the true number of civilians killed during the so-called War on Terror. Former President Donald Trump, who infamously vowed to bomb the Daesh and their families while subsequently loosening rules of engagement meant to protect civilians, signed a 2019 executive order revoking an Obama-era requirement that the Director of National Intelligence publish an annual report on civilian deaths caused by drone strikes in areas outside of war zones, but under U.S. attack, including Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, and Libya. During the tenure of the former President Barack Obama, who dramatically escalated unmanned aerial drone strikes, CIA Director John Brennan claimed that not a single civilian was killed by airstrikes in Pakistan in nearly 1 year period in 2010 to 2011, during which the Bureau of Investigative Journalism counted dozens of casualties. Obama, under whom U.S. forces bombed medical facilities, homes, weddings, funerals, first responders, U.S. citizens, and allied forces, also redefined the term militant to include all military-age males in a designated strike zone in an attempt to artificially lure civilian casualty counts. The administration of former President George W. Bush, who invaded Iraq under false pretenses and under whom the majority of civilian deaths in the war on terror he started occurred, also repeatedly came under fire for undercounting civilian casualties. As General Tommy Franks infamously declared on the eve of the Iraq invasion, we don't do body counts. While such an attitude makes it virtually impossible to tell exactly how many men, women, and children have been killed by U.S. forces over the past 2 decades of unending war, estimates range from around 500,000 to well over 1 million.
Reporters. Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this is the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters, advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden.
This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. To avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, and that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Mara Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meats through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US dollar annual budget. The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceedings of the budget, calling it an IMF dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us a reduced share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development, and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small, and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds, and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. 7 EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious that tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated. People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say. Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door. These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the Jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the Jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The June 18th presidential vote draws to a close in Iran, and candidates are on a tight schedule, trying to make the best of the remaining time to attract more public support. In addition to televised campaigns, candidates now visit universities and other key places to increase their popularity among people from different walks of life.
When I make a promise, I'll give you a clear roadmap that shows every step of my plan. For example, if I promise to solve the issue of housing, I will give you the exact timeline of of the procedure and the number of houses that I will build for the people who don't have a house.
We try to analyze the current state of affairs in Iran and create plans that are based on real circumstances of our society. We concluded that we could make tangible changes based on our plans.
All of the seven contenders have rich executive backgrounds, from sitting atop the judicial branch to running the Central Bank of Iran. But perhaps their past plays the least part in winning the race, since it's what they plan for the future that matters to voters.
I have a special plans regarding the exchange market. I believe that the capital market plays a significant role in financing the concert industries.
If I took office, I would eliminate the coronavirus once and for all within less than 6 months. I also have comprehensive health policies that would reduce the cost significantly for patients.
We do have plans, but we cannot break them down to their details during a limited time of campaigns. God willing, if I'm elected president, I will operate those plans.
Aside from electoral campaigns, which are mostly held in the form of televised addresses, the candidates face off in live debates. So far, the seven runners have attended two televised debates. The first was themed with economy, and the second centered on social affairs. The third and final showdown is slated for June 12th. Unlike previous rounds where the elections were more of a clash of the parties, this time it's a race of plans. Plans that can ensure a better economy and a brighter future for Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The blame Iran game has been going on for years, but most times it's a ploy used in the Middle East. This time, however, British right-wing newspapers are linking the Islamic Republic to the independence push in Scotland and Wales.
Ever since the very real threat of a potential UK breakup reached the forefront of British politics, stories have begun emerging claiming that Iran-linked social media accounts are spreading fake news online, or that Tehran is somehow building working relations with several anti-Westminster political parties. They've all been doing the rounds. However, are these stories true, and where do they come from?
Political experts in Scotland are far from convinced.
The idea is preposterous. This is desperation. This is a desperate attempt to push back against the momentum that built up in support of Scottish independence. And the ghouls of the British establishment are looking for external bogeymen and scapegoats, when they really should be looking in the mirror to understand why Scottish independence has now gained the firm support of the majority of people living in Scotland. And if anything, it's Britain that interferes in Iranian politics, interferes in the politics of countless countries across the world due to its malign role.
The latest story released by The Telegraph on June the 6th bases its report on work done by UK-based think tank the Henry Jackson Society, whose reputation has been in question many times before.
Henry Jackson Society is well known for its extreme views, extreme right views, extremely pro-Zionist, with bells on, and Islamophobe by its nature. As a matter of fact, is being sort of highlighted by just about every Muslim organization or every other sort of human rights organization as something which was set up to bring extreme right-wing policies into British politics.
Ironically, for British media, the UK's long-standing reputation of meddling in other countries' affairs seems to undermine their attempts to derail the independence train, which has clearly left the station. Robert Carter, London.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique, as the president said when President Moon visited. The animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping, as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not, and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Gharibabadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homa Lesky, Vienna.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.